Dr. Future, Mrs. Future, are you there?
Hello. Hello.
Hi.
Corey.
Hey.
Nice show today, Corey.
Yes, I'm very worried about the Chinese menace. I'm going to go duck and cover now.
I can tell. They're your best friends.
I don't dislike China as a nation. I don't think we should.
I agree with you. I'm a big fan of China. I think China and America are so much alike, just like every place in the world. We're full of diversity.
Are we a melting pot after all?
Well, you know, by the way, I am concerned about societies in some of the Middle Eastern countries, where they'll head if they have change. I think they'll get worse and will be worse for women and stuff. China is every year seeming to get better.
Absolutely. When I was in China, Corey, many years ago, right when it became available for Westerners to
travel.
Back
in the early 80s.
In the early 80s, I went there and there were people practicing speaking English in the parks, and someone walked up to me and said, you know, in China, we believe that America is wise and China is poor, as if poor was the opposite of wise. And I believe that the people from China that I've met love America.
My dealings are all the same. I've actually had real business dealings with them for the last 17 years. I don't mean that I buy things from China, that I've actually done business and established business in China. And, you know, literally seeing them go from a very closed banking society where it was difficult to get money or in and out of the country and do real transactions to a much more open market country.
Their politics are harder to define. They're not quite Republican-Democrat kind of ideologue going on there.
No, but they have 6,000 years of history. The culture is so different. I think we really have to be very careful judging what we don't really understand.
True. Judgment is one thing, but trying to understand it's another.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, I think they have ways to go on religious tolerance and on, you know, differences and stuff, and they do.
Yeah.
But our best friends are Saudi Arabia, and women can't even drive cars over there.
Yeah, It's amazing how strange the planet is from one society to the other.
And Pakistan's our partner in peace, and they have Sharia law. So we pick and choose who we get angry at.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
what's on your show today?
Well, first of all, Carrie, I was thinking of you on the way down here, and what a gorgeous day it is outside, and how we have all these issues we're pondering about, how much greater it would be if we could be on the beach doing it. And I was thinking, you know, certainly NAB and the technology is at a point where we can get quality communications wherever we're at. You're able to do it remotely. Why not do it outside?
Well, by the way, this is like a secondary method I'm on right now. My actual primary method of communicating with the station is having technical issues. So I'm actually doing it by another method today.
Are you? Yeah, because it does sound a little different. You have more
different.
It's not quite as good as your home setup, but it's definitely...
Yeah, normally I have an ISDN line and a special units that they give me, but they're having issues with those, so I'm coming to you over Skype today.
Oh, okay. So this is a Skype. I would suggest playing with different microphones and seeing what works for you.
Sure.
Yeah. Are you using a headset or a separate mic?
I am using a headset, but no, this is not what you consider to be a... My kids wouldn't even use this headset. They'd laugh this headset off.
Oh, yeah. I think if you get one of the blue microphones or something like that, it could be pretty high quality. The USB mics.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
So what's going on the show for you today for the people to tune in?
We're bringing on one of the original hackers, Captain Crunch, John Draper.
Today is going to be a really interesting show about DIY technology and literacy, both bio literacy and gear literacy and information literacy.
Biohacking is becoming a big thing today, and so we thought we'd talk to the original hacker to see what he thinks about this. Biohacking is going to make us much more cognizant of how to play with molecules the way we currently play with bits and bytes and photons. And when that happens, it has implications. It makes molecules much more like the way we play with Photoshop and Premiere and various programs online. The 3D printers allow us to just start to move molecules around. It has implications. So we're looking at that. We're looking at that whole issue today.
Well, that actually sounds really interesting, because in the first hour we were talking a little bit about surveillance and government following people around using technology to know where you are 24/7. And is that healthy for society?
Yeah. Like if you have machines that do these things, do you make the machines illegal? Because after all, if we have machines that can manipulate molecules, that means you could like create any drug you want. Things like that. It no longer becomes important about the molecule. It becomes about the technology that allows you to have that freedom.
Replicators.
Yeah, so replicators became illegal because they would give everyone the power to create anything.
That's right.
You know, what does that mean? In terms anyway, something to think about.
We will find out in your show.
Yeah, thanks.
Take care.
Yeah, good talking to you.
Time now for What's Left and Dr. Future on AM 1080 KSCO Santa Cruz.
What are you doing?
Good afternoon, everyone.
Make that noise.
Guess what this is?
A mistake or an accident.
Welcome to the Dr. Future Show.
This is Dr. Future working out.
New toy I just got from Amazon. Two of them, actually.
Radio is no longer a spectator sport. This is participate with shaker weights.
You would give it away.
The worst. Oh, I guess we're going to have people calling in. I'm sorry. You have to tell me these things.
It's okay.
It's
one of the things that endears me to you is your timing on jokes.
Oops. So sorry.
It's okay.
Did anybody have any other guesses what Dr. Future was doing? Just what the heck?
In case you just tuned in now and you might wonder.
Shaking the salt shaker.
Actually, there's two of them. It's pretty interesting. If you had stereo out there.
It's funny how I met you and you were shaking them and I completely just blocked them out because I didn't feel like I had the time.
Oh, the whole thing. Well, you know, the shaker weights are kind of interesting. We had a friend turn me on to them who's really into the bouncer, little bouncer thing, and he says he combines the bouncer with the shaker weights and swears by it, and it's his major form of exercise next to his computer.
He practices it every day. He claims that because of bouncing, his spine is actually expanded instead of contracted, and that the shaker weights are just the rest of the picture for the full body workout.
So. Now, Mrs. Future, I believe I have seen movies of you with these shaker weights.
That little Facebook expose.
That's when I decided to order two.
He really liked me using those shaker weights, you know?
It's pretty funny
fun
until
to
I,
watch?
It's pretty funny until I saw the South Park episode on shaker weights. I don't even want to go there.
I noticed it right away. These shaker weights, they not only give you good upper body arm strength, but they really give you that particular motion that men love, that women love for women
There's
to do for them.
Something very soothing and stimulating about these things. I don't know what it is. It's probably biological.
Well, it seems like if you make it to South Park, then you've got a hit. on your hands, and it's probably the beginning of the wave of shaker weights.
But I've been getting ideas about these. I'm thinking that the sound, for example, you should be able to play with the sound so that they become like a musical instrument, and then you can join your friends who are musicians, and you can be getting in shape while you shake your weights.
This is a completely unsolicited endorsement.
I don't know. It's just an idea right now.
Dr. Future is very excited.
Entrepreneurial.
It could be
like a form of cucarachas or something. What do they call it?
they're pretty inadequate as an instrument. I mean, you would have to be so strong
just not
to make
satisfying enough for instrument
noise.
Sound. It feels great in terms of exercise.
Well,
but,
you know, we were going to have the show talk a lot about DIY.
Yes.
This is a DIY moment. I think that there's got to be some solution.
And what's more DIY than your exercise routine?
Right. Adding noise or adding sounds.
And making it more fun.
Musical.
Like it becomes playing music.
Right. And then we could all stand in a
Not just
a
listening
circle.
To it, but you're making it.
And I'll tell you, these could easily be very cool robot fingers. They're very cool gear. They're satisfying gadgets. Right? Low tech, kind of.
Yeah.
Happy post-resurrection.
Thank you.
And Happy Easter. Cedar.
Oh, my goodness.
Hanukkah. It was a big religious weekend.
That's true.
You with your fam?
I was with my family.
The rituals were going strong.
We roasted a lamb.
Oh.
Really?
Is that a Serbian tradition?
Yes, it is. Lamb is for Easter. Pig is for Christmas.
Did it resurrect?
No, but boy, it was good eating. I tell you, it was really good. Andy brought his...
Oh, Andy is
He brought the La
Quina,
La Caja Quina.
Uh-huh.
La Caja Quina.
Is that a Portuguese thing?
I don't know what it is, but it's a wooden box, and it's got handles on it, and it's actually on wheels. And it's lined with aluminum, and you have a top, and it's where you put the charcoal, and then the heat circulates in the aluminum box. And so you get this incredibly juicy...
Oh, so it's like a slow roasting box.
Right, exactly.
Oh,
it was unbelievable. Now, we did the pig for Christmas, but it was a windy day. And so it took like... Which should have taken 2 hours. It took like 5 hours. So we didn't get to eat.
You had beautiful weather down there in San Diego, I bet.
So we didn't get to eat till 7 on Christmas. But for Easter, we ate at like 2 in the afternoon. And it was tremendous. I made a little movie about it, as a matter of fact.
Where's the movie?
It's on the YouTube, the Muse Cinemedia YouTube.
Oh.
And you can see it there, and maybe Dr. Futchel.
That is our personal website, folks. We actually run a media company, the three of us.
And we post lots of cute movies on YouTube.
Yeah. Right. So this is like the La Quina.
Not just radio personalities.
La Caja Quina.
Yeah.
It could be a commercial for them. It really, I mean, it's unbelievable how good. It was the best lamb I've ever had in my life. And
wow.
We eat lamb every year. So.
All right.
I've had a few.
Well, I know who you. We're calling them for a sponsorship.
Yeah. I was just going to tag them.
Close
see
enough.
How many people will come to see it, and then I'll think, hey, La Caja Quina. Check it out. And my sister said it was, for them, it was a big boom to their relationship because it was the first time that they were watching the Shoppers channel, and they both wanted it.
Oh.
Usually it's one or the other.
That's how you know you're compatible.
That's when they held hands
we want
across.
The same late night product.
Yes.
Let's order it, honey.
Oh, I love you too. Hey, if you can shop with your friend, then.
I tell you, I thought it was true love before now.
Yes.
But I'm glad to see it's getting confirmed in all those little ways that are so important.
Yes. It's just one late night we saw it, and that's how it came into our lives.
Wow. Congratulations, Andy and Barbie.
Onward to some of the other news today.
Some fantastic news.
Well, you know, Easter is a kind of death and rebirth.
That's right,
I look
resurrection.
At it, right? And so the death part in the science world this week was the budget crunch.
Oh, yes.
Put the SETI telescopes into mothballs.
Tell us a little bit about the SETI. What was the SETI for our audience?
Well, the SETI is the sort of on-again, off-again, ragtag team of astronomers and science lovers of various sorts, disciplines, who believe that we should keep an eye out there for possible signs of intelligence somewhere else in the universe.
Yes, search for extraterrestrial
intelligence.
And
of course, there's a lot of ways to define what intelligence is and a lot of ways to define what extraterrestrial is. But nonetheless, there have been experiments. And one of the grandest experiments of late was a field of dishes aimed in the sky, scanning for radio waves.
Coming at us.
Radio
waves
to see if there's any
being sent to us from other possible intelligent
possibly
creatures.
Other places in the universe. And
right.
Radio telescopes were quite big back in the 50s when they first started. And radio was the answer, like what you're listening to now. We said, hey, this is the cat's meow in terms of communication. If anybody's intelligent, they'll use this.
Yeah, and, you know, we've spoken with people like Jill Tarter, who was kind of one of the pioneers of starting how to communicate with extraterrestrial life. And the astronomers of the day were really using their best science to look out into the universe and say, well, if we wanted to communicate with someone that was 100 million light years away, what would we use? And so that's how they decided to look for
it's a self-reflective
radio
process.
Astronomy patterns.
Oh, so is that who Jodie Foster is playing in the movie Contact? Because this sounds awfully familiar.
It's a long time thing. It's really,
if it's modeled on anyone, I would say it's Jill Tarter.
Yeah.
Yes,
so
she is
Jodie
the woman.
Foster. So we have to get her
Drake
to make
also.
Contact too.
Yeah.
Drake's Equation, looking for intelligence in the universe, and Dr. Drake is here at UCSC. He's the one that initially tried to figure out, given how big the universe is, how many intelligent civilizations might there be out there?
Right. The probabilities.
Yeah, given the type of planet that we need to have life as we know it on it. And,
so you're saying, Dr. Future, that they're slashing SETI?
Yeah, they created
we've given up on extraterrestrial life?
A field of radio dishes.
Or just communication.
No, it's just the way. And the way I look at it is just the way we decided now that maybe radio isn't the highest way to look for other forms of intelligence. I think that's what's going on. I think there's a shift in focus.
Radio is no longer state-of-the-art.
But this was a state-of-the-art radio experiment, listening to thousands of frequencies at once, thousands of stars as well. You know, not just one star at a time. Being able to get whole fields in the sky and looking at see what they are and just going around and looking at different parts of the sky, see what we find, but it's still radio waves.
Now, is this a Carl Sagan?
Yeah, Carl was definitely into this.
Carl Sagan, he was a pioneer, the grand what would you say, PR person for?
He was. He was a great evangelist for scientific research.
Astronomy.
Exactly.
And
billions and billions of stars.
Who wasn't affected by cosmos?
Exactly.
I know I was greatly affected.
Well, now we know there were billions of galaxies, so it's one step beyond even what we thought. And then there's the Millennium Simulation, which took all the information we know about the universe, put it into a 3D animation. Yeah, just search Millennium Simulation. You'll see what the universe looks like all the way zoomed out, consisting of galactic superclusters by the millions, each with a million galaxies. It's unbelievable where we are.
We need a cosmos, too.
And that's on YouTube. What happened on April 22nd is that Tom Pearson, CEO of the SETI Institute in Mountain View, sent out a letter to all the donors saying that their project has been put into hibernation. Meaning starting this week, all the equipment is unavailable for normal observations and is being maintained in a safe state.
So Good Friday was the last day for SETI as well.
What an appropriate day.
Yeah.
Hopefully it will resurrect also.
Yeah.
Well, SETI will come back.
Yeah. I don't think I think the more we learn about the universe, the more
that'll
we want to know.
A re-SETI.
A re-SETI.
A re-SETI. Well, in a sense, it's a reboot, for sure.
Hopefully it's SETI 2.0.
And hopefully we'll get a warm reboot. We won't have to completely start over. Even that would be better than no reboot.
Something better that we can use
well,
now?
Well, as I said,
have we given up on communicating with beyond our planet?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, that's the other side of this equation. You know, the Easter equation, the death-rebirth cycle. In the rebirth, the resurrection phase, there just came out... I just found out about it this morning, about possible ET disclosure from within our government.
Now, hold on, Dr. Future. One second. Because this sounds
this
real.
This could be disinformation.
This could be really big.
It probably isn't. It probably is something
but it might
strange,
be.
But it's interesting
and
nonetheless.
If it was. But what I wanted to just tell our lovely audience that if they're interested in seeing the articles that we're talking about, if they are just happen to be near a computer and they want to
tune in real time, read the details.
They could go to ksco.com/Dr. Future. And what you get is you get the page with the article in which we were talking about. And it's through this incredible scientific, this program called Sinecast. Dr. Future, we have a phone call.
Okay.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, we've got.
Hello.
We got Bill from Capitola. Welcome, Bill.
Hi. I was just listening to the program, and I missed what you said about the area you could go on the web to. It was the Millennium View of the Universe. Is that what it was called?
Millennium Simulation. Like in Millennium.
Right. Simulation. Perfect.
Simulation.
That's all.
And
yeah. Hey, great show.
Oh, thank you.
The buzzword you want is the Max Planck Institute.
Well, Millennium Simulation.
Simulation.
Will find it. Yeah, there's lots of versions of it, some with different music tracks. Different artists have gotten a hold of it and done things to it.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you very much. Wonderful show.
Thanks,
Bill.
Bye. Bye-bye. Millennium Simulation is awesome. You know, what's interesting also is that when you look at the universe all the way zoomed out and you see literally millions of galaxies and galactic superclusters, and you realize that even the myths that we grew up with, the science fiction we grew up with, like Star Trek or Star Wars, took place in one galaxy or a quarter of the galaxy in the case of the Federation space.
Oh, yeah. I love
and
to see those like science fiction statistics about how small the Star Trek galaxy is compared to everything we
actually
know.
Actually is there?
So listen, I found the website for our listener, Bill. It's mpa-garching.mpg.
Yeah. Yeah,
you can.
There's lots of versions of it. People have put Pink Floyd to the Millennium Simulation. Because what you do is you zoom into a galactic supercluster at hyperlight speeds. Speeds far, far exceeding the speed of light. Not warp 10, not warp 11, or like warp 9 million. It's profound. Really, you can see why they put it to Pink Floyd music. So I was getting into the other side of the coin here, the rebirth element in the ET story.
Oh,
I guess it's going to be rebirth after the commercial.
After a break from our sponsors.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about, though, Dr. Future.
Well, it's something from an organization known as the NSA.
The
right?
NSA?
Yeah.
Is that the National Science Administration?
Security.
This is top secret, but
not
it's
anymore.
Been revealed.
Right, you'll see.
Stay tuned.
Dr. Future Show, KSEO.
Okay. Okay, I was going to reveal to you this information from the NSA, but we have a call. So why don't we get a call first?
Well, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Jay is on the line from Salinas. Hey, Jay, welcome to the show.
Yes, I was responding in regards to the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI.
Yes.
That, for example, Carl Sagan and all boosted and espoused back in the 80s and even before then. And now they have essentially given up on it because of apparently poor results from trying to communicate with such a vast cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps the money and funds can be applied to expanded search for asteroids and comets that might come dangerously close to us in the future. That would be one place to use the funds.
Yeah, it makes sense. I can see that. It's like a bird in the hand or in the bush. You know, we know that those are going to kill us, you know, the asteroids, and we don't know anything about ETs. So.
Yes, and then the elites of the world, this is not a conspiracy theory. The elites of the world, like you and you and I, could get forewarning and then go ahead and find our cave, which is stocked with food and water, and jump in there and hide and hope to survive on an impact collision with an extraterrestrial object. But the other thing about the vastness of the cosmos and just our galaxy alone is that even if traveling at the speed of light, in addition to I don't want to be found and discovered as the planet Earth any alien form.
That's true. Any form of colonization hasn't been so good for those being colonized.
I see. We should stop making crank calls to the far ends of the universe. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. No.
Well, it could be dangerous. Yeah, the unknown is a strange place.
Yes. At best, perhaps they would be coldly logical and rational and just observe us, and they would certainly have tremendous power to control, I would guess, if they were able to come these distances, because the closest star, Alpha Centauri, is like 4 or 4.5 light years away, and we can only travel at thousands of miles an hour versus the speed of light, 186,000 miles a second.
You have a
point. Can't even got.
Do you think it would? Now, let me ask you this. Do you think it would make any difference if they perceived that the universe was alive?
Alive. You know, I appreciate the miracle of the planet Earth. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, hundreds of millions of us do want us to prosper and expand our conscious knowledge and development. And I think that is a more and more becoming a goal of especially the younger generations, that we want to apply our power to the expanding research and development of both the external sciences, physics and chemistry,
And biological sciences.
And then the biological sciences, which are, my gosh, are defining who we are and what we are and defining what human conscious.
For example, I often speculate whether or not nature, in considering the complete intelligence of all the species that are on this planet, whether or not collectively they are aware of other biological intelligences in the universe. You know, maybe our species might not. Well, maybe the collective intelligence of all
biological
life.
You mean like maybe there are bacteria that are putting out some kind of wave to the universe to reach people like us?
Well, who knows? Maybe trees, maybe fancy antennas as well as whatever else they do,
that reminds me of an article that we're going to talk about.
It does.
Who really knows?
It reminds me of an article, too.
Hey, thanks for the call, Jay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Appreciate your comments, Jay.
Yeah.
Really.
Dr. Future is
totally tuned in to some of these great links that Dr. Future is about to share.
Yes. Congratulations to all the living things on planet Earth. Let's keep communicating with each other.
Exactly. Yeah. Interspecies contact.
Here.
Good start.
Now.
Eh? Yeah.
Good
keep
job.
Keep us alive for sure.
Yeah, you bet.
All right.
Have a great day, Jay.
Thanks, Jay.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Future, you've had some information you've been wanting to share with us.
It's,
Spill the beans,
I don't know if
please.
There's anything to it, really. But it's interesting. It came in as the resurrection part of the story, of the ET story this week, about NSA document that, in a sense, admits that we had ET contact. Now, that's not something the government usually does, right?
Yeah, and remember the crop circle with the Crabtree alien? We thought maybe that was ET contact, but we never had the government actually telling us it was ET contact, right? Pure speculation.
In this case, this was a document that was of a communication that supposedly came from space back in the 50s, picked up by Sputnik. Right? This is really original stuff. And it's been top secret until 2004, whereupon it was declassified. But it was declassified in a very clever way, where it was misfiled and not found easily. Until I guess our search algorithms got good enough.
You think that's clever, do you, Dr. Future?
Depends on what side of the equation you're on.
Clever?
Timing is everything, as they say in the movie business.
So it was cleverly misfiled.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Accidentally on purpose, yeah.
Anyway, it just came out.
What happened?
And it's probably going to be ignored by most people, but nonetheless, it's got my attention. It's a satellite message of a code. And a Dr. Howard Campagne, C-A-M-P-A-I-G-N-E, and some other NSA super mathematicians were given this code that came in, and they were given the task of decoding it. And there were 29 messages that were received.
Decoded by NSA super mathematicians.
Yeah, okay. And it's very interesting. They actually published the actual message, you know. And if any of you have interest in puzzles, if you know, tweaking little puzzles where you are trying to figure out codes.
If you're bored with the New York Times crossword
you
puzzle,
want
to try your hand at some cryptology.
It's very interesting. I mean, it's being passed off as an ET code, but any of you out there know anything about cryptography? Some people might say, oh, that's an ancient Nazi code from 43 that was used. There might be some history to this. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm not a cryptographer. And that's why we're bringing on some more
and yet,
minds onto this
equation.
Don't
leave out some of the clues, some of the important clues for who would really appreciate this search, because the NSA super mathematicians do have something that they believe is a correct interpretation of the code.
That's right.
They give us
the whole decoding and how they decoded it.
They give us the code and their...
And you're bringing this to our audience, Dr. Future? The code is very simple.
Anybody can figure it out. It's our audience.
First of all, there's like two lines. From what I can see, the first two lines are the key to understanding the crypto code. Like the first line does dot, 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 dot. And so it's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, up to number 23. So what the NSA guys did is that they assigned it to letters. So there are letters, almost the whole alphabet except the last few letters.
Okay, so this is 1960s technology. You got the Sputnik up there. 1950s. Yeah. The Sputnik is up there, and it's picking up this Morse code, this empty space signal. And then they're recognizing a pattern. You know, that's what SETI was trying to do. It was looking for an anomalous
pattern. If SETI got something like this, it would be...
in an otherwise sea of chaos. Right?
Yeah, and if SETI had picked up something like this, it would have been unbelievable.
Well,
right?
Who's to say they did?
If it was taken seriously.
That's right. You know, maybe the universe wrote back.
But anyway, let me explain more about the code. The next line, it was like A, it would do dot, dot, B, dot, 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 C, dot, dot, dot. And it would create a second layer of the code. So you could then combine letters that would have more meaning. You can actually create a whole language from the first two lines. Take a look at the first two lines.
It's really
interesting. I mean,
this comes out right after they closed down SETI. No,
it's totally ironic. Hey, we have a phone call for Dr.
Okay,
Future.
And I'll tell you, they did interpret it, and I want to tell you that next, but let's take our call.
Okay, so this is RC from Aptos. Welcome.
Welcome to Earth.
Is that your job, bringing to Earth? Hi, RC.
Take me to your leader.
Michael's whirling?
You know,
where I come from, there are no leaders, or we all are, one of the two.
There's only one leader. It's all of us.
You know, as far as ETs, extraterrestrials visiting this planet,
yes.
I believe that aliens have been here in the past.
Yes.
But when they got here, mm-hmm. Bigfoot kicked their butt.
That's really funny.
That's mine, by the way. Don't use that.
It's out there. We can't hold it back now. Sorry.
Yeah, I think there's also some giant sign around our planet that says, slow, children at play.
emphasis on slow caution. Children.
But what I know about the topic, I read this article in the Discovery magazine a few years ago. And after I read it, I'm thoroughly convinced that it's highly unlikely that we'll ever get a message from any ET. And that any ET will ever get a message from us. Actually, SETI came out with information just a couple of years ago that explained that the television and radio broadcasts that we're sending out there into space actually dissipate into noise after about a year, after they've traveled about one light year.
Mm-hmm. So from a normal linear time-space perspective, they only go out a light year before it dissipates.
Yeah, that means they don't even get to the nearest star.
They don't. So any alien who's anticipating watching the first episode of The Honeymooners or watching Super Bowl
One. Wait a minute.
The first Olympics. Wasn't it the German Olympics was the first radio wave?
Here's some speculation for it. What does get from star to star is the light. Right? We can all see the lights. So that's pretty evident that light is connecting the universe with itself in some level, at least from what we can see.
Oh, I like that. We're a light-based universe.
And then what if that information wasn't just random photons? What if it was organized information in ways that we just cannot comprehend as a simple little species on one planet?
Yeah, of course, if there was
it does connect us all.
If there was intelligence out there, they'd have to figure out another way. They probably would find out some sophisticated way to let their presence known.
Like some kind of radio, television, telepathic network, perhaps?
Okay, so you're just saying it wouldn't be radio, but you're allowing that it could maybe be something we haven't thought of or used just
yet. Yeah, who knows? Maybe they can generate the power of, what are those things, quasars or pulsars, the flashlights?
And
generate the power of that. I have no idea. I'm rambling on and talking about stuff I don't know.
Yeah, that's right.
Local, we're only sending messages locally, and we just cannot shout loud enough to get to any ETs.
But the article that I read said a couple things that I thought were fascinating, and one is how life arrived here on Earth. And what makes life so abundant on Earth is, one, is that we have this freakishly large moon that is an anomaly. And it happened as a result of a freak accident, a Mars-sized planet impacting the Earth and forming the moon. And that, of course, stabilizes our tilt and gives us mild seasonal variations, which life can take advantage of because there is not chaotic seasonal variation. So that's one. The other one, of course, we're right in the sweet spot of the solar system.
The Goldilocks zone is the exoplanetary, people call it.
So we have water in a liquid form. Also, we have Jupiter, which is our protector, which essentially acts as a vacuum and cleans up the solar system of comets and asteroids that might hit us.
Panspermia.
Now, on the other hand, sometimes Jupiter's orbit kicks asteroids and comets into the inner solar system.
Right, as I've heard about that. The Kuiper Belt kicks a few down this direction so often.
I'll tell you, the big ones in my lifetime, Jupiter took the hit for us, and I'm very grateful.
Yeah. That could have had our name on it, but it took a hit for us. And we saw that. And if that happened in the first 100 years of our technology, then I wonder how many times that has happened before. It's probably a very common
It's kind of a bio reboot, in a way, wouldn't you say?
Exactly.
Yeah, we would call them mass planetary extinctions.
Exactly. And one more thing is evolution. Evolution, as we know, doesn't necessarily walk towards high technology. For example, the dinosaurs, who were much more successful than us. Human beings have controlled the planet for maybe 10,000 years. Dinosaurs controlled it for about 150 million years.
It's unbelievable. Wonder how far they got.
And of all the lineage and all the different species of dinosaurs, not one of them was able to produce high technology.
Yeah.
So that's found.
Maybe that's a secret hidden in the Middle East somewhere.
So that's another great point, life doesn't necessarily march towards high technology.
That's true. It's probably very rare, actually.
Yeah, so my point is, I'm not looking forward to seeing E.T. anytime soon because of those factors. However, if it does happen, I'll be the first one to say, I told you so.
All right.
Okay, I'm out of banter here.
All right, thanks, man. Thanks. Appreciate your input.
Thanks for that, RC of Aptos. Okay. Thank you for calling. All right, Dr. Future.
Now I will, in the next piece, I will reveal what the NSA was able to figure out from this ET transmission.
I can hardly wait. Please stay tuned here at KSCO. If you want to join in on the call, please give us a call at 479-1080. And we would love to hear from you. Hope you're having fun. We are.
Okay, we're back to the Dr. Feature Show. Boy, we had a lot of stories, but these two ET stories, the death resurrection stories,
we've
really taken the show, huh?
That's right.
Okay,
Dr.
Well, let's continue then.
Dr. Feature, we've got Whitney on the phone from Santa Cruz. Welcome.
Hey, Whitney.
How you doing?
So you have evidence of alien activity?
Well, back in 1979, you ever heard of the Billy Meyer case?
Oh, of course, yeah, the Pleiadians. The Pleiadians, the Nordics. They were the Nordic aliens that supposedly came into through Switzerland.
Ben
Lomond? No.
No, not Ben Lomond. That's where you lived.
They're Scottish. Sorry.
Scottish aliens. They're not Nordic aliens.
So anyway, they were here through 1984. And then they left.
Right. Right.
I'd say that's pretty good evidence. And there's a DVD about them. And
yes.
Actual footage.
Yes. And Sam Jay's, I think, was the transmission. They used telepathy. The beautiful.
Amazing. Yeah.
They talked about using beautiful women to convey information into cultures because male egos could handle it better. I think there's one thing I remember.
What?
Yeah.
Explain that to me. Hold on.
That has to do with the mental state of their brain is so far advanced they can't handle our negative energy.
Right. And also males would consider other males to be a threat.
So you have to use beautiful women to communicate with the Palladians.
The Palladians would use beautiful women to
seduce
our men into knowledge.
Seduce our men into knowledge.
Because they would have knowledge, star knowledge, that men would more likely listen to beautiful women than they would to other men.
I don't buy that.
Not for us enlightened men, but you know, for the generals and stuff, they
are
take.
You saying that you don't like to get knowledge from beautiful women?
Who?
You. Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that...
Mrs. Holt, fourth grade.
The mental state of mankind is not as advanced as they are. They have a problem with being close to our energy.
Yeah.
And they need to stay at least 290 feet away to even communicate.
Yeah, that sounds like radioactivity almost, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So, Whitney, were you... Did you experience this? Did you
experience?
No. I found this stuff on the YouTube.
Mm-hmm. You just have an interest in.
I have an interest in it, and I bought the book.
Yeah. It was pretty profound. There was a whole series. There was a technology book, a Pleiadian technology book that was quite interesting.
How do you spell that, Dr. Future?
Like the star system, Pleiadian, P-L-E-I.
That's the way we
it's
actually Pleiadian.
Is that your radio going on in the background? It's kind of
it kind of work.
Yeah, it doesn't quite
work.
Okay,
that's
us,
okay. Yeah. Whitney, thanks.
All right, well, thanks for the Pleiadian reference. They definitely, well, you see, there have always classically been good aliens and bad aliens in various stories. And
these are good aliens.
These are good ones. I think there was another story about how there were actually 57 varieties of aliens that our government was in touch with. They used to joke about it, calling it the Heinz 57.
Right. I've heard that.
Yeah.
We didn't want their help, so they...
Yeah, there's a lot, and they are many, and it's a deep topic, and it opens up a whole chapter of pseudoscience.
And, you know, this is the
Coast
to Coast channel, and I know there have been many, many hours of good radio devoted to this topic. And
it's
so
interesting. It's interesting.
Michael Horn is another knowledgeable person who lives down in L.A. who is actually representing Billy Meyer at this point.
Michael Horn. What struck me also was the telepathy, because I began to get the idea that communication could happen inside rather than through electronics, that our bio systems were capable of receiving remote signals.
Right. You know, and now you're getting mental telepathy.
Yeah, exactly. And that it's much easier to move consciousness around than it is to move tin ships through the universe, you know, which makes sense to me, too. So, especially if you embrace the idea that maybe it's all alive and, you know, it's part of a larger organism. But we won't go there. just yet.
Okay.
Hey, thanks a lot, Whitney. Have a great day.
Thank you.
All right, you too.
Thanks for the call. Bye-bye. All right, Dr. Future.
Yeah.
So there's still something left of the original.
Oh, yes. I wanted to complete this because the NSA boys really got into this.
And now, we're talking about the declassification.
Yes, the thing that was declassified in 2004 and then finally from the 50s and then finally put out there. Here we go. SETI dies, you know, and they were just looking for anything, right? And so the NSA has been decrypting this incredible document that's been around for since the 50 years. And what does it tell you?
And this just came out 2 days ago, or April 24th.
The whole code is there for you, but just, I kid you not, this just came out. It's the entire code. Even if it was made up, it's amazing that someone would think this up. And the code basically, after detailed analysis here, which you can read step by step if you're a code head.
And where would they find this information?
We have several places you can find this information. Let's tell them. Sinecast is our host, and we have KSCO.com/Dr. Future, and you can go to the official ET disclosure. NSA document admits ET contact by Kevin W. Smith. Also, I have placed a link directly to the code on our Twitter feed, Dr. Future Show, just Dr. Future Show on Twitter or drfutureshow.com.
And it will show up
in our Twitter feed, which is on all our pages.
Okay, and also drfutureshow.com/links, and we have links to this. And it's the NSA Technical Journal, Volume 14, Number 1, Unclassified.
Wow.
And it's the key to extraterrestrial messages. They figured out that it was several equations and the periodic table of elements. The entire periodic table of elements apparently was transmitted in this simple code.
The
first two lines are the code key from what I can see, and the rest of it is the periodic table of elements.
So that's what our NSA super mathematicians conclude from this random Sputnik transmission.
And I think about it, it's a periodic table of elements. What does that really tell you? It tells you what the physical matter universe consists of in terms of molecules that we know about.
Yeah, it's the geometry of matter, right?
So it seems like it would have some value to know that they know that, that we know that. It would be at least 19th century knowledge of how the universe works, which is good. And they're assuming that you need at least that knowledge to be able to decode the periodic table of elements. I thought that was a pretty cool thing to be able to figure out how to send people using two lines of instructions. You know, and as a feat in and of itself, it's quite interesting. Now, if SETI had this, they would be funded. If this was real. If somebody's sending us periodic table of elements, as a code, what does that tell you?
Isn't that funny that the whole SETI program came into being, had its full life, and ended while this message was in mothballs in the NSA
top secret
vault.
Land.
Oh, yeah, because it had been accidentally or specifically misfiled.
Yeah, for the last,
50.
Since 2004.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
7 years. Right?
7 years.
But the rest of the time it was classified. So, and then, you can see.
Somebody's playing a bad joke on us.
Well, it's interesting. It comes out now. And the other thing is that I'm kind of curious about what these other equations are that came with it. And I have a theory. In science, we sort of test our theories to see if they're true or not. They said it was Sputnik that picked this up. Now, Sputnik was a really primitive spacecraft. It was back in the 50s. It was Russian. It was the one that scared America into
having our own space program.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's, my God, look at what this Russians doing. So I'm thinking that it must not have been that great at receiving information. It must have been better at transmitting it. So I'm thinking that maybe this got confused in the sauce here, and that maybe this was a message that Sputnik was sending out to the universe, that maybe the Russian crypto code people wrote our periodic table of element into a code, and they were trying to send it out to the universe as their thing that they wanted
to
share.
It's Mendeleev's
message. This is what we know. Right, so that the Russians figured out how to send the ETs a message from us that told them that we knew about the periodic table of elements.
That's brilliant.
That's my theory.
Brilliant, Dr. Future. Hey, Vernon is on the phone.
Oh,
all right.
Yay. So Vernon will have something good
Vernon
to say
from
about
SoCal.
This.
And I'm not driving. And yes, I agreed with Dr. Future last time on the road that we need to be willing to take the risks. Life is not without its risks.
Yes, indeed.
Anyway, the question I have is, what is collective intelligence and how would it manifest? How would we know? I'm going to let you answer that real quick, and then I'll make a comment.
Real quick.
That's a good question to answer
well,
quick.
Well, Vernon, I consider you part of my collective intelligence.
I do, too. You know what I think I am in the scheme of collective intelligence? I think I'm one of the neurons firing off in God's brain like those thoughts in ours that won't go away.
Yeah, exactly.
Until it does.
Microcosm, macrocosm. Yeah, I'd agree.
As much as he tries to meditate, I'm one of those ones that won't float right through at this moment. Just a thought, anyway.
Yeah, I like it.
Anyway, the second one had to do with light and waves and transmitting information out into the universe through light. Since light has both particle and wave properties, is the probability of light interacting with other photons and other particles as you go out increases? And I wonder if it wouldn't get swamped out there because, you know, the intensity of any source drops off as the square of the distance. And when you deal with what they call second-order effects in quantum mechanics, they're very weak.
Right. Well, if you consider the entire thing as being intelligent, it would be processing the information all throughout its entire system. So it goes as far as it needs to go, you know, before the information is processed in some way.
That's true. You know, maybe we need to listen to Stephen Hawking, though, that said that, you know, if there is other life out there, we should probably consider it to be much like ours, survivalistic, and we just might be another good meal source.
Well, there's always that. But then there is the experience of communicating with it, which can help allay those fears.
Yeah.
Also, Vern, if I traveled, you know, half a few millennium light years across the universe, I don't know if I would really be picking up things to eat when I got there. I would probably try and bring stuff with me.
Well, you're depending. What if you feed on photons? If you're sophisticated enough to travel across the universe, like, food would be kind of amusing concept to you.
Hey, you know, maybe the photons would just get sucked up as a food source.
And, exactly.
And what I like is I like being part of your collective intelligence out here. And in the manifestation, as our neurons fire and we titillate each other, it's just really a lot of fun.
Yeah, we might come up with something new even, you know?
That would be interesting.
We're here to help the superorganism.
Yeah, you know what the nerds in the valley are calling it? They're calling it crowdsourcing. Crowdsourcing.
Well, you know, what comes to mind is a rose by any other name is still a rose. You can rename things as much as you want. Cloud computing is just internet-based stuff, right?
There's cloud computing and crowdsourcing.
Well, that's cool, you know.
Yeah, they're all reflecting a lot of things that are going on with human intelligence and other levels, like talk radio.
That's right. And the thing is so cool is we finally did prevail, us of the past. We're running the show.
Absolutely. All right.
Okay, you're about ready to go to a break.
We're going to bring on Captain Crunch. He's going to add his two cents worth.
I'll be listening.
All right. Thanks a lot, Brian.
Thanks, Vernon. Thanks for checking in.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for your connective intelligence. As well as collective.
Okay, so tell us quick about...
Well, I think since, you know, we're talking about codes and stuff like that, we usually get into one of the basic DNA of Silicon Valley has been Captain Crunch's work with Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs in the early days in the Blue Box and the whole experience of hacking and how that applies to today's scenario. So we're going to ask the captain about some of our modern-day situations, see what he has to say.
Woohoo!
Great.
Stay tuned. KSCO.com.
Santa Cruz.
Having fun with the Dr. Future Show. Second hour up next.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show, the second hour, our interview hour. As you know, we were talking about the new information from the NSA, whether it's disinformation. It's kind of a strange code hacking kind of thing. So I thought we'd bring in the original hacker himself, Captain Crunch, or Crunchman, depending on how you call him. He's a computer programmer and the original phone freak that we've all heard and known and loved and part of the DNA of Silicon Valley.
What is phone freak?
Well, before the internet, there was another network, a vast network of which John was quite knowledgeable. Are you there, John?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you. I see you even.
Welcome to the show.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure this thing was working.
Yeah, you're working
now
great.
I know.
Man. Yeah. For the uninitiated, John, what was that network before the internet that was the kind of like a nervous system for us all?
The ARPANET.
The ARPANET. Were you part of that too?
Oh, yeah, I got on the ARPANET. I had access to a tip. access to Stanford and MIT. In fact, I played Stanford against MIT in chess by duplicating the moves. MIT won. It was the Greenblatt program, by the way.
The Green program, huh? So that was some of the first. That was the early internet. Okay, but there was a parallel network with the internet that was going on that connected us all. That you're well known for. Remember that one? Can we say AT&T?
Yeah. Of course, the phone network. Yeah.
The blue box and all that kind of stuff. That was like
we were doing everything that people are doing now on the internet, except we're doing it in voice.
Isn't that interesting? Now we're getting back to voice again with Skype and...
You know, John, I wonder, could you kind of tell everybody how you got your name, Captain Crunch?
Yeah, there was a whistle in the Captain Crunch cereal box that if you glued one of the holes up would send the magic frequency of 2600 hertz. When that signal got sent into the phone line, it would disconnect your long-distance calls.
Disconnect them?
All of them, yeah. In fact... A good hacker phone freak pastime would be at the airport just to walk along the payphone banks at the airport blowing 2600 whistles. It would disconnect everybody's call.
And you got this in a Captain Crunch cereal box?
I didn't really.
That was a blind hacker.
Name kind of got stuck to me.
You publicized it.
In a conference call, I was using my real name. Huh. Being really naive, I didn't really care. I wasn't doing anything illegal, I didn't think, at the time.
Yeah.
I was just participating in a conference call. They asked me, what name do you want to be called? And I says, I don't know. And I says, is Captain Crunch taken? And I was in the whistle, and they said, no, that's a good name. You are here and called Captain Crunch, and sort of the name stuck. Remember, that was before all the media, it was before all the news.
Yeah.
This was a very private... Everything the phone freaks did was kept well under wraps, with the exception of the Esquire article. Once that article came out, that blew away.
That took away a lot of the fun at that point.
Yeah, the phone freak was never the same after that.
After it became public,
I read that article, I says, "Oh my God, phone freak as we know it has now ceased to exist."
Yeah. So you guys were kind of like just power crank callers, right?
Not really. We were more interested in learning and understanding the system and sharing information back and forth in our different groups.
Like how it worked, right?
You were
anatomists of the system in a way.
There was the L.A. group, mm-hmm. and then there was the Seattle group. Now, in the L.A. group was Mark Bernay. In the Seattle group was Al Bernay. And Mark Bernay and Al Bernay are really the fathers of phone freaking. They are like the number one phone freaks. They were around long before I was.
Were they brothers or something?
No, they're not brothers. It's just the name that they picked. Oh. Why they picked the name, I don't know.
Okay. So they were the Wright brothers of the hacking world.
Then from Mark Bernay came Denny and Jimmy in San Jose, and then I met Denny and Jimmy through a personal meeting after they identified themselves. And I met Denny by accident, actually. I was experimenting around with an FM transmitter.
Oh.
And he picked up the signal and called me.
Weren't you into, pirate radio back then, those days, too?
Yeah, I was. We were operating San Jose Free Radio.
Was that KCUF? Was that
No, we didn't have call letters. We were totally against being
call letters,
conformity.
Huh?
We were strictly very underground, very radical, a lot of references to pot. We even had commercials relating to pot.
And that was pretty radical back in the early 70s.
Less, yeah.
You have all your gear packed in the back of the plumber's truck or something like that? And
I just had a Volkswagen van, and they had a coffin box with the two turntables in there.
I see, two turntables, huh? So you're a serious music player, too.
Yeah, we had a nice microphone, two turntables, and a DC transmitter.
You didn't have an address on the radio dial? You just drove around?
We were fixed when we were operating. We couldn't drive with the turntables running.
So you have to find a good location to park and then start transmitting.
Well, we would go up on the mountain peaks, and there was lots and lots of ridges where the roads end in a lookout, and we'd go up there and park. And we almost got busted when we were up at Mount Lick Observatory. We were in the parking lot of Mount Lick Observatory broadcasting from there. It was our best location.
Yeah? You can get all of San Jose that way, yeah?
Well, we get all of San Jose, all of Santa Cruz, all of San Francisco, and all of the Central Valley. So we were getting in Stockton and Modesto and Tracy. We're getting everywhere. We're like weak, but we were weak all over.
Week all over.
FM or AM?
FM, we were operating on, I believe it was 89.1 megahertz. Huh. We had 65 watts. And so we was in the parking lot of the Lick Observatory when Jerry down the hill. Mm-hmm. There's a ranger station on the way up to Mount Lick. He was down at the ranger station at a parking place just watching traffic coming up. Huh. He had direct line of sight to us with a flashlight. So he sent out a signal FCC in Morse code. We picked it up, and John was on the air, I think. And I says, I think we got a visitor from Charlie.
And so you had an 11-mile run or something up the mountain before they got to you, I guess. Eh?
Yeah. John says, well, we have about enough time to finish this Pink Floyd cut before we're going to shut down. But he stayed on the air right up until the last minute. Actually, just as they were rounding around the last bend, we were still on the air looking at the car. God. It was this white station wagon van with government license plates on it.
So what made you so confident that you could, like, not get in trouble at that point?
Well, the minute they went around behind the observatory to get up into the parking lot, if you've ever been to Lick Observatory, the last few feet of road, you wind up in the back access, back behind the Lick Observatory, and you come up along the side and into the front where you can see the valley. Hmm. We shut it down just as they were riding around the bend. We pulled the antenna in, closed up the sunroof, we put the cushions back on the coffin box, and which doubled as a seat, and we pulled the curtains, and we drove down.
And they didn't even stop you, huh?
No, I was waving at them as they were coming up.
Pirate radio.
Yeah. Well, that was a heyday of pilot radio. That was before the internet, right?
So. Yeah. Who has to do that now?
Yeah.
By the way, I got reestablished to some of the people in the San Jose Free Radio. And what they want to do now is they want to set up an internet fan club.
Internet fan club of pirate radio?
Yeah, no, like, it's San Jose Free Radio fan club.
Huh. What would you talk about today? I mean, practically anything is allowed on the internet radio these days. So.
We're going to keep it underground as much as we can. We've got a lot of... I'm not sure exactly who's going to run it. I'm not going to run it.
Yeah, you're just going to have fun with it, right? You can maybe have some reminiscences.
I might be on it once in a while. But I'm not interested in being on it on a regular basis. Yeah. So the other things that I'm doing now also is I'm working on a new movie called Hack This Movie.
Oh, yes, Vito Tums.
So you've got to go to Hack This Movie up on Facebook. They're always looking for people to donate.
Is this like a crowdsourced funding kind of project?
We've got an amazing amount of footage that we can add. We just don't have the money and the resources to put it together and make it into a movie.
You said Hack This Movie. Is that a .com, a .net?
Yeah.
Hackthismovie.com.
Yeah, I believe that's it, yeah.
Open source model for creating and distributing a film.
Yeah, I believe it might even be going through Kickstarter. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I've had a lot of people who've Starter been successful with that.
Is a wonderful resource for people just getting started and getting off that they can't afford to do it otherwise. They bid on a partnership with the people or the listeners or their donors or whatever.
Yeah. Are you going to look at the history of hacking with this film?
There's lots of absolutely amazing interviews. An amazing interview with Steve Wozniak, amazing interview with Andy Hertzfeld. I mean, the list goes on and on. It's a parade of some of the top people ever put together in one film. You're not going to believe how many people are going to be on it.
So lots of...
I have an upcoming event. I'm also going to be going on a speaking thing. I'm actually working on my book as well. The speaking thing, my first big public talk will be in Bogota, Colombia at the end of June, early July.
Well, is there an event happening there?
There's an event called the Campus Party, and I'm a keynote speaker there.
Now, is this modern-day hacking? I mean, you talk about internet hacking now. Is that the real buzz? What about all this biohacking that's starting to happen? Is there any cross-pollination in your world with biofreaks? No?
What do they do there? Do they do biological research and DNA and stuff like that?
Well, it starts with, like, 12 ways to hack your houseplants. And goes from there. The thing is, with this new book out called Biopunk, which is looking at the rising tide of biohacker movement.
Yeah, well, I'm into some really, really wild stuff. I can't talk about it. You know what telomeres are?
Yeah, they have to do the aging process. I know that, there are little tails on each cell that slowly get shorter as you get older. Like a fuse, when you run out of telomeres, you die kind of thing. They're like cell death process of some sort.
Yeah, there are new and revolutionary techniques for rejuvenating the telomeres because this is actually an age reversal process.
Huh.
So it's not just rejuvenation, it's actually age reversal, and I'm looking into that really seriously.
Well, that's right. You've been dealing with some serious physical pain for some time now, right?
Yeah, you have no idea.
It sounds like you've got some serious drugs you've been having to take. Yeah.
Actually, no. I haven't been on any painkillers in a while.
Oh.
Because I had a cortisone shot a couple weeks ago.
Oh, I got you. Hey, listen, John, can you hold on a sec? We've got to go to a break, and I'll
be right here when you come back.
All right, thanks, man.
More with Captain Crunch?
Yeah, more Captain Crunch. He's got some more stories to share.
Stay tuned.
Back to KSEO and the Dr. Vija Show with John Draper, the original hackers. Not just the phone system, the computers. And I think one of your classic stories, John, goes back to the, I guess you could say, Apple's first portable device, the Blue Box.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was the...
Now tell us, how did you meet Woz and Jobs? What's the actual meeting? What was that?
I got a call from a friend of mine in Berkeley who worked for KPFA, who knew Steve from a UC Berkeley dorm campus.
No, which side? Steve Jobs or Steve Wozniak?
Wozniak.
Okay.
And so he talked me into meeting the guy. I was very hesitant to meet anybody about the Blue Box because I was very paranoid at the time.
Because by this time you'd already had some run-ins with the law regarding the Blue Box.
Well, not exactly. I was still free of what to try yet, but I knew they were on to me. So I had to be really careful.
Yeah, yeah.
So I go to visit Woz in the dorm, and that was the first time I met him and had learned he was building a box using digital circuits instead of analog. Hmm. And I watched him that... using the digital output.
Was that new for you, too, the first time you saw a digital Blue Box?
Yeah, it was amazing that he could do it. I mean, wow, this guy's a genius. So he had the tones close enough to be within tolerance, and it worked quite well. You never had to tune it. It was always guaranteed to be on frequency. It's one good aspect about it. You had to be really careful about how you hooked up the mouthpiece to the phone. You can't just, like, jam it up on the phone and have it work. You have to hold it away from the phone at just the right amount of distance. And very often it wouldn't work. And as a result of the use of this Blue Box, a number of people that he sold the Blue Box to got busted, primarily because they were detected.
Wasn't this like a dorm room thing where they would where you guys would show the Blue Box off to some students and like
I mean that's exactly what happened. We met in the dorm. He showed me his Blue Box. He asked me to show him how to use it.
Yeah.
I gave him the access codes to the overseas trunks, and from there he could call any country if he just knew the country code. So he says, "Can I call the Pope?" I said, "Yeah, I guess so. It's in Italy, right?"
Oh, hey, so John, can I just interject here? One of the things I love about Woz that maybe the audience doesn't know is that he was a he had an answering machine joke business, and he just loved to do telephone jokes. Like, he was the original telephone joke meister.
Yeah, and I'm sure that he wanted to also call the Pope up with some kind of a joke, but... It happened to be 3 o'clock in the morning at the Vatican when we called, and we did get a phone receptionist answering the call, and they said call back in like 5 hours or something. Then they would make an appointment to see the Pope.
Oh, I see. It's like the middle of the night or something.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what the procedures are for actually getting to talk to the man, but I'm sure that if you are the right person, you can. They'll probably. You know, come to the phone.
But they didn't wake the Pope for you, huh?
No. And, well, I mean, I handed it over to Woz. I sort of sat back and chuckled.
Well, what's the closest you ever got to a celebrity or a high political figure?
Well, a political figure that I actually met was Congressman Pete McCloskey at a...
I was talking about reaching them over the Blue Box. or something like that.
Oh, you mean, yeah, okay. You want me to talk about the White House?
Oh, that's a good one, yeah. Yeah, let's tell the audience about
that.
Yeah,
well, Kirsten, you're never going to let me get away without talking about that.
No, I couldn't.
Come
no.
on, yeah. This is going to be on the web. We too. Want your whole it's story, man.
Website, webcrunchers.com/... actually, it's just webcrunchers.com now.
In your own words, yeah.
Well, we basically got access. We found through scanning some numbers the person at the other end after we got the number. We wanted to know who they were. They weren't very willing to tell us that.
Hmm. In the White House?
Just to get off the line, not to call again. So I said to myself, now that's an interesting number. Why would they want to do that? And I said, the reason why they wanted to do that must be some government office because it was in Washington, D.C.
Yeah. What was the area code? I mean, was it a 202?
We figured that it was a government office, only for government people to call in. And it was a very important number, which raised all kinds of flags and got my interest in trying to figure out.
Was it an unusual area code?
Yeah, no, yeah, it was 800-424. All Washington, D.C. numbers back then were 800-424. I called the number, and after about 2 to 3 weeks, we got a storyline together. We needed more information on the number. We had the capability of sitting on the line and listening to conversations. It just so happens to work in Washington, D.C. It doesn't work everywhere.
Yeah.
We waited for a while. Somebody did come on the line, and they asked for Olympus. And we said, well, that's a pretty bogus name. Who would be called Olympus?
Olympus, huh?
So when the person came on the line, he sounded remarkably like Nixon. I wrote down Olympus Nixon, 800-424-9337. So it goes something like this. We called up the number. Mm-hmm. In a way that they couldn't trace us.
Because you know that we're going to want to do that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We asked for Olympus.
Ooh.
And sure enough, Olympus came on the line. And my other friend grabbed the phone from me and said, sir, we're out of toilet paper. This is a national crisis. Help us.
He's saying, who is this? Who is this?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the guys at the other end were really, really dumb.
Are you telling me Ukraine called Nixon?
Yeah,
you told him he was out of toilet paper.
You told him it
was top bat.
Oh.
But I bet the Wise must have made a few crank calls in his time.
Well, from what I remember, didn't he try to demonstrate by calling around the world to the phone next to you? You need to go through all the demo.
Well, I did that.
Oh, you did? Was that hard to do? I mean, you basically...
Oh, it was pretty easy.
Just tell the audience what you basically did for that. You had two phones, different lines, but you wanted to call the one next to you by going it all the way around the world. Something like that, right?
We called to the UK. There was a number in the UK that we can use 2280 hertz signaling.
Uh-huh.
From that, we zipped over to Australia, which used 600 hertz signaling, a different signaling altogether. This only worked if the country that you call uses different signaling standards. Because if you use the same signaling standard to disconnect, it would disconnect and leave you all the way back to where you were.
But back in the 70s, you had to have some social engineering too, right? I mean, you had to actually talk to operators and stuff?
No, we never talked to operators in this. This was all done through signaling.
Really? Okay, so it was the first totally automatic way of calling yourself.
Yeah, and each country that we called had a different standard, so we had, and so one wouldn't interfere with the other. And that was the only reason why it was possible.
Sure.
Because if you send the 2600, you're going to go all the way back to the last truck you were on to get it. Huh. You could use guard banding, which means you could put another frequency along with 2600 and send that along. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, but not often, it'll wink forward and leave you on a trunk further away from where you are. And from there, you can go somewhere else. And from there, you can go somewhere else.
Uh-huh.
That's all tandem stacking.
So what was the most fun for you, John, on this doing this? I mean, what really motivated you?
Well, let me say this, tandem stacking. You go to wideweb.com.
wideweb.com/phone-trips,
and there's a thing called classic tandem stacking. I highly recommend you go to that website and listen to that audio. That audio is a very classic example of tandem stacking. And it was done by a guy by the name of Doorbell, who is also one of the persons, along with a few others, which I cannot name, were involved in this very tricky art of manipulating the phone company in ways nobody could ever imagine.
So, John, I've been trying. I tried that link and doing phone trips at. I did wideweb.com/phone trips, and it's the link appears to be broken.
I got it.
Okay,
then to wideweb. Maybe it's wideweb.net.
Wideweb.com/phone trips works just great.
Okay.
There's a picture of you and at a phone booth, as a matter of fact.
That's the one.
Yep. It looks
go in there and look for classic tandem stacking, and when you find it, put some of it on the air and let people hear it. It's going to be quite entertaining.
Okay. Stacking local offices. I see.
It's called Classic Tandem Stacking by Doorbell.
Okay, let's see.
It's in there somewhere.
Okay, let's see. Classic Tandem. Yeah, I got it. Trunking set in January 1975. Evan Doorbell made recordings by phone.
Yeah. That was when it was happening in 75. Yeah, that was the thing.
Those are the days, huh? Okay.
75. Let me give you a chronological analysis of what, how and when they worked and when it didn't work. In 75, that was when it was totally open. There wasn't that much people using blue boxes back then. Mm-hmm. And it was like a frontier. It was like this open land and nobody in it. Mm. 76 started to get a little bit tight with my bust in 76, which I wasn't busted for phone for blue boxes back then. It was another thing, really unrelated. But then now 76 and 77 mm-hmm. was when the phone company started switching over to CCIS signaling, which is signaling outside the wire pair instead of inside.
Mm-hmm. That made and it much harder then.
At that point, more and more trunks, more and more 800 numbers, you couldn't whistle them off. You couldn't send a clear signal. It wouldn't do anything.
Yeah.
By 1978 and 1979, only about 5% of the trunks worked. And by 1979 and 1980, there were very, very few trunks left.
Yeah, so it was pretty much dead at that point in terms of being able to.
Well, it was. You could still do stuff on it.
Yeah,
but you couldn't really. It was very dangerous. Number one, because those are being watched now.
Right. And plus, the law was all over it, and anybody who was into phone freaking was getting in deep doggy doo doo.
Those are definitely not something.
And that was really when you transitioned more to computers, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, in 77, I did the phone board interface.
Yeah, now tell us about that. There was it was an early product of Apple Computer. For the Apple II computer, right? It was 76?
The winter 76, summer 77.
Mm-hmm.
Wozniak hired me on a part-time basis as a contractor mm-hmm. for developing the phone interface board for the computer, because Woz thought it would be really nice to have a nice telephone interface to the Apple II. No one else had that.
Well, it would take it way beyond an answering machine in terms of its capability.
Oh, yeah. It was totally programmable.
What could you do with it? Give us some feature sets.
You could do anything with it that you could do that when you detect a tone. You can detect tones with it. From detecting the tones, you can. And with a little bit of work, you could actually recognize speech. But mostly you could just detect tones and, of course, send any tone. So you can both send and receive any tone of any frequency. You had software control of the hook switch, which means you can pick up the phone and hang up the phone. It was under software controlled. You could send audio through the phone.
You could record messages. You could send messages.
Yeah, you could take messages and record them. And
So this was kind of a computerized phone answering machine in the days before they really existed.
You could probably make it a robo dialer, or it would call numbers.
You
can
make it into anything
messages.
You want. You could actually make it into an automatic attendant that could come up there and take your call. What number do you want? You could do store and forward. If I wanted to send you a message and you weren't there, I would store and forward your number. Then when you got home, you got a call. The minute you used your phone, it would detect that, and then your phone would then ring with a stored message that I left for you 2 hours ago.
Wow. Yeah, and there were no answering machines available anywhere at this time, right? This was before modems.
The problem with the phone board, and this was one of the big key features of the phone board, is you had to be approved by AT&T Bell Labs.
Oh, that's right. Everything had to be AT&T back then.
So we had to jump through hoops to make sure that our signals were compatible and that we were using the proper transformers, and the transformers weren't saturating with a DC current through the phone line.
Right.
There was all kinds of problems that we had.
Yeah.
And we had to solve each of these problems. And then the cost of the phone board then started becoming really high. And that was one of the main reasons why Jobs probably didn't want to market it. It was too much of a liability for Apple to make and sell those things. People could program these boards to do anything they want, including having evil thoughts.
I see. So it really was too much freedom at too soon.
Way too much freedom too soon with the phone network. AT&T did not like that phone board one bit.
Yeah.
Okay, well. That seems like a good chapter for this part of the show.
Yeah, I can imagine what something like that would be today on the net.
I would like to talk this time. I'd like to talk a little bit about what I'm planning to do in the future.
Okay, so how about right after the break?
Dr. Future.
Right? Yeah, that's right. We saved the last segment for the best here. So we're going to take a break, John. We'll come back and we'll really look at what's next.
Yeah, see you after the break.
Okay, man. Take care.
You are listening to the Dr. Future Show with our guest, Captain Crunch. Stay tuned for more here at KSEO 1080.
With spring in bloom and summer fast approaching, envision a great meal at the Casablanca restaurant with its great service, award-winning wine list, full bar, unparalleled cuisine, and spectacular views. Spend a memorable getaway weekend at the Casablanca Inn with its unique and individually appointed rooms, and again, those spectacular views. The Casablanca Restaurant and Inn, corner of Beach and Main in Santa Cruz. Call 831-426-9063. And don't forget Casablanca's famous Mother's Day brunch. Listen to Good Morning Monterey Bay for your chance to win San Jose Sharks playoff tickets.
Brought to you in part by Play It Again Sports. When you go out to play, save lots of money and have just as much fun when you play it again with the quality pre-owned sports gear you'll find every day at family-owned and operated Play It Again Sports on Soquel Drive in Soquel Village. It's new and used sporting goods at Play It Again Sports.
Proud sponsor of the San Jose Sharks. If you use it all the time, buy it. But if you only use it once in a while, rent it from A Tool Shed Rentals. A Tool Shed is the rental place for contractors and homeowners throughout the South San Francisco and Monterey Bay areas because they always have the lowest out-the-door prices and they never charge you cleaning or hidden fees or sales tax. Listen to some of the things you can rent at A Tool Shed.
Tractors, skid steers, skip loaders, riding trenches, garden tractors, Z-booms, stick booms, scissor lifts, single-person lifts, scaffolding, rotor tillers, weed mowers, hedge trimmers, backpack blowers, jackhammers, concrete floats, compressor packages, concrete vibrators, airless sprayers, wallpaper steamers, sewer snakes, carpet cleaners, indoor lifts, dump trucks, flatbed trucks, and more, much more.
If you use it all the time, buy it. But if you only use it once in a while, rent it from A Tool Shed Rentals. Get the lowest out-the-door price at A Tool Shed Rentals, with 7 convenient locations to serve you throughout the South San Francisco and Monterey Bay areas. Rent it at A Tool Shed Rentals. Listen to Good Morning Monterey Bay on KSCO for your chance to win San Jose Sharks playoff tickets.
Brought to you in part by Eric's Deli Cafe. When you get hungry for the real food prepared by your friends and neighbors at Eric's Deli Cafes, where the soup is always on, the sandwiches always have character, and the service is always prompt and courteous. Satisfy your hunger at local Eric's Deli Cafe.
Proud sponsor of the San Jose Sharks.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Okay, we're going to go through 20 years in almost 20 seconds here because we're going to take John into the future. But first, we're going to take from the phone world, you went into the computer world, you worked with Woz and Jobs and Apple, and you designed the phone board, and then you went on and started your own company and designed one of the first word processors for the microcomputer revolution, the Easy Writer, in the late 70s. And then you went on to doing all kinds of other software projects in the 80s and went on a tour of Europe in 1989 with the Chaos Computer Club, which is when I got to know you even better because I was on a tour for my book. I had written a book called Virus about computer viruses at the time. And in the 90s, I guess you were still doing indie work, right? And you got into security, internet security, which and you came up with something called the Crunch Box, which was getting into the hardware and protecting people on a very basic level with the internet. And where are you today, John? What's going on now?
Well, I'm officially retired from programming.
Okay.
Since I'm now 68 years old, I figured, you know, It's not that I'm like giving up or anything. I'm just going off and doing new things. Mm-hmm. One of the new things I'm doing right now is I'm doing a sort of like council on ecological solutions and vision. There are five basic fundamental things in our society today that need fixing.
Uh-huh.
One is our financial system. It's one big Ponzi scheme. We've got to get rid of it. We've got to get rid of money.
So you're into banksters have been in charge too long, huh?
Yep, exactly. We want to work on a barter scale on a local basis, local community systems.
Sophisticated barter? I mean, with possible...
In the community system. You're trading your skills mm-hmm. for someone who needs your skills.
Uh-huh.
And that person that you're trading with has things that you need, like perhaps food or something else. Mm-hmm. If you go to EcoViso, ECOViso.com, you'll see the very fundamental ideas of some of the ideas that we're doing. We're bringing out to light new technologies that no one has ever heard of before. For instance, they have these nanotube super hypercapacitors, which were developed by this MIT student who graduated about a year and a half ago, started a company called FastCap.com. This company called FastCap.com aims to come out with a capacitor instead of a lithium-ion battery. It's going to be a capacitor that has more storage capacity than a capacitor.
Now, for the uninitiated, capacitors can charge a lot faster than batteries, right?
Right, but they can't. But they discharge a lot faster.
But this kind can discharge more slowly, like a battery. So it can charge like a capacitor.
But it can hold a lot more storage.
Yeah.
I mean, a capacitor today, by weight, if you get a 25 kilowatt, you know, it'd have to weigh like 200 tons or something. But a typical electric car will require approximately anywhere between 25 and 30 kilowatt hours of energy. That means that when you're driving down the road, you may not use the full power, maybe perhaps going up a steep hill, but it varies. And as you go down the hill, you're actually putting energy into the battery if your car is designed right. Some of our vision includes the idea that auto companies like GM should go into the battery-making business. They should start making batteries or even using these FastCap system batteries, which have about five times the capacity of a normal lithium-ion battery. Huh. They could charge... It could charge, the limit of how fast it can charge is based on the thickness of the wire before it melts. Yeah. Okay, it's like that.
Well, how come if they're so good, they're not out yet? Is it just
it's fresh research. They're solving
brand new stuff.
Problems.
Huh? Yeah, so yeah, they would use in electric cars if they were working.
Exactly.
Out.
If these were used in electric cars, and if this does what this guy claims it can do.
Yeah.
We're talking about extending the driving range of an electric car out to maybe 600 or 700 miles.
Holy moly. Yeah, they go to L.A. easily.
And you pull into a gas station, you could charge your car in about a half an hour.
Wow.
So, you know, but the energy that your car is going to absorb in that half hour has got to be six times the energy that the car is going to use while it's driving on the road. It's all a matter of watt hours, how much watt you use per hour.
Yeah.
So if you want to dump in a huge amount of power quickly... You have to have a lot of current going into that battery.
High voltage stations.
But when your car is draining from that battery as it's driving down the road, just on a straightaway.
Yes.
You know, we're talking maybe Maybe 1 or 2 kilowatts of power, depending on the size of the car and what's, you know.
Right, but the charging station is going to be a much, you know, like a.
Well, there's two
big charge, right?
Two thoughts I'm nurturing here in this vision that I have.
Okay.
Number one, autos. There has to be an electric vehicle summit, a gathering of electric vehicle manufacturers, all working together to come up with a standard docking mechanism. In their battery packs.
For the charging mechanism. Packs. Gotcha.
No, the capacitor packs. The thing that go down the car.
Yes.
So the idea is you drop these out from the bottom of the car. You wheel in another one. You hook it up. You plug it in. You nail it down. And you charge the driver a replacement fee and off they go. They're not leasing the batteries.
Oh, I see.
Mean, they're leasing the batteries. They're not buying it.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Blue Rhino propane gas cans.
So when you buy a car, you're not paying the full price of the car because you're not paying for the battery, which, by the way, lithium-ion battery packs in cars are roughly $18,000. And you have to replace these after every 2 or 3 years, which is kind of a bad thing.
Yes.
Is giving electric cars not a very good name. They have limited range. You know, we're talking anywhere between 80 to 100 miles before it needs to charge again.
Yeah, so this really makes
the
difference.
The problem, too, with these watch stations. You'll see more and more of these pop up in parking lots and stuff.
Uh-huh.
You plug your car into a watch station, and you can charge your car while you're shopping.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they have some of those in Santa Cruz. There's a lot of garages that have electric vehicle charge stations.
Yeah, Apple parking lot has one, too.
But if we go to this new capacitor technology, we're going to have to re-standardize to that.
Well, electric power into the homes have got to be able to handle the instantaneous surge of power required to put charge into these cars.
Right.
And we're talking about instantaneous power consumption somewhere between 8 to 10 times normal power consumption inside the house. So if your average house runs with anywhere between 5,000 watts per hour, let's say that's a lot of watts per hour.
Yeah.
Okay, but to charge a car, okay, you got to figure what car electric battery, what, work out the math. We're talking 28,000 watt hour battery.
Yeah, it's huge. Hey, John, we got
to charge that. You'd have to put 28,000 watts in it and you charge it in and out.
Yeah, so you've got to have charge stations take a huge amount of charge really quickly. Which requires a very specialized design, which we need to get on to work. But we need the batteries. It's a chicken and egg thing. We need the batteries. We need the chargers. Hey, listen, we got a caller. Would you like to take a caller?
Yeah, please. Let's take some calls.
Okay. Yeah, son?
Okay. Yeah. Hi. We have Rick from Scotts Valley. And here we go. Hey, Rick, you're on the air.
Thank you.
Hi, Rick.
Hi. Oddball question. Could you put one of these ultracapacitors in a suitcase and discharge it fast enough to create an EMP pulse large enough to destroy electronics?
I don't think so, because the thickness of the wires needed for that kind of power there would be no way to do that because the terminals of the battery itself. You see, if you short-circuit one of these batteries, these supercapacitor batteries, I could imagine that anything you put across the terminals is literally going to just instantly vaporize. I mean, it's like an explosion, which, of course, is a safety factor for these batteries. You definitely don't want to put anything across the terminals of these things. You will be in for a lower world of a big surprise.
There's no way you could put one of these on board an airplane, figure out a way to discharge it so that it would create an EMP pulse to interfere with
electronics. You would have to have some kind of a loop wire with rather thick gauge.
Mm-hmm.
It would have to be pretty wide, and you couldn't get that on a plane.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess you'd have to think about this a little bit. Terror-proofing the technology, I guess you might call that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's pretty far-fetched.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I guess you want to think of the new technologies that we use. We don't want them to be easily used to.
They don't want to put any ideas in their heads.
No, but you need to think of these things through in advance because all things could be used for many purposes. Technology is a multi-edged sword, as they say.
Yeah.
So so super high voltage could be used for. They tried to make it illegal back in the turn.
Electric cars used to run on 380 volt systems.
Yeah. Okay, well, as long as it's within the capacity to run the car and not kill people easily, I guess that.
You couldn't go any lower than that because the thickness of the wires would be your big issue.
Yeah.
Going to the motor.
But this would, too, be the turning point for electric cars. But it would move them into a pragmatic world, right, where they had a decent range.
Yeah. And there has to be a lot of cooperation from just about everybody. Car companies have got to cooperate with service stations who would be providing these battery packs for the motorist fully charged. In the back, they'd have to have some kind of a solar panel or wind generators supplying the power to charge these batteries.
The charge stations,
would actually theoretically be running on totally renewable power.
Uh-huh. So these could be a new business. This could be a new, new type of business all over the country then.
Or you can get it from the grid too, and if you get it from the grid, I mean that's an easy way to do it. But you really want to get off the grid as much as possible.
But so initially, it probably would be grid power. Yeah, but I can see how you
could set up these service stations out in the desert with large solar panels and windmills, and then have these dumping power into these capacitors that passing motorists will need to push onward. Mm-hmm. And they could just take the dead ones and plug them up, because they're all going to be a standard size and weight.
Right,
it's a
really
interesting idea. So instead of a fill-up, it's a battery replacement.
So right, exactly. I mean, that can go really quick.
Or, like
you can have a charge. Yeah. If you go, and it'll probably cost you less to have a charge than it would be to have it replaced. So you could go into your restaurant, have food, purchase some stuff, take pictures, whatever, and then you come out to your car and it's fully charged with the same battery. So service stations would have to offer both types of services.
It's a model that's been around. I mean, I think Blue Rhino uses it for propane tanks.
If you go to betterplace.com, there is an electric vehicle corridor right now between Seattle and San Ysidro. It's San Diego and Seattle. There is electric vehicle corridor where you could drive along the road, and at any point along that way, you could charge your car.
Gotcha. So places like Better Place would be the ones to have these services.
So betterplace.org, and they have a lot of, I think it's betterplace.com or betterplace.org. Try either one.
Okay.
Okay, we have another caller. You're ready for another question there? Okay, hang on, John. Let me bring in Steve from Monterey. And hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to remind everybody of is just for example, the battery for the Chevy Volt is over 6 feet tall, and it weighs 450 pounds.
That's significant.
And with a subsidized cost of the battery is over $10,000 for that car.
Yeah.
So that's something that, if we start talking about these convenient plug-in battery packs, we do have to talk about what it takes to actually make a battery, what's in a battery, and how do we dispose of them.
Good point.
Yeah. Well, the fast cap systems aren't using any of those dangerous chemicals like lithium ion and stuff. So, and in the future, hydro fuel cells are another source, and hydrogen fuel cells. And we haven't even talked about that. But Alan, if you have Larry Voss on your show sometime soon, you got to Gary Voss. I'm sorry, Gary Voss on your show sometime. You're going to have to get this guy on the air because this guy's got some amazing technology.
So he's got technologies that will reduce the size of the power plant. Sounds like that would be very helpful.
And also, I'd like to address Steve's concern about, the toxicity of this industry, this battery industry. And I kind of think the idea of having a full battery replacement and then commercializing the whole process, including the reclamation or the recycling, makes a lot of sense. If you take that out of the hands of the individual consumers, then you have less people disposing of it improperly.
And then the companies themselves who lease the batteries would then be responsible for the proper disposal of the batteries after they're not usable anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, then if you look to the future, to the hydrogen fuel cell, I think...
And a lot of that stuff can also be recycled.
Sure. No, that's actually a very viable technology, as expensive as it is. But I think people keep looking for this mystery battery that has yet to be invented. And we're looking to the car companies to come up with this mystery battery instead of the people who already have, and that's called NASA. Car companies are not going to invent a new battery. I've been hearing for 50 years that there's this, quote, new battery just around the corner. And, yeah, we've gone with lithium ion and nickel metal hydride and everything else. But bottom line is these are old, like new versions of old inventions.
Wasn't there a battery that was in the movie about who killed the electric car? I mean, wasn't there?
Well, that movie was something of a slant on the truth.
Oh.
I mean, yeah. those cars were leased out with the knowledge that they were not going to be long-term viable in the market anyway, because the real cost of the battery in that car was well over $30,000 at that time.
Yeah,
they were pretty expensive.
Yeah, so the battery is the boondoggle of this.
Yeah, like I said, if you're looking to who's going to develop the best battery, it's going to be NASA. And what they've come up with is hydrogen fuel cells, which is, you know, a clean way to generate electricity.
They're the only ones right now making the batteries.
Right, and the flip side, too, to not to stick a pin in it, but you also, when you start talking about hydrogen fuel cells, then you start taking away the emissions that we're all taxed on. So then the government has to come up with a new scheme to tax us for not putting out emissions and putting out pure water vapor.
Yeah, it's going to get very expensive to be a carbon unit very soon, isn't it?
Yeah, because they're already talking about ways to tax electric cars, because they're using the roads without paying a gas tax, so that they have to come up with a special way to tax all electric cars.
Oh, that reminds me. Another viable way to actually move vehicles along the roadway are the roadways themselves having the power, but through magnetic induction.
Yes.
And the cars would be going down the freeway at a fixed speed, like riding a wave in the ocean. And the way that can be done through very expensive infrastructure improvement. Mm. But quarters.
Hey John, 45 seconds before.
Okay.
We go.
So the idea is you would pay for this by electronic means. We'll talk about that later.
Okay, that's
everybody
show.
Can have their own little maglev smart
thanks,
car.
Everybody.
Yeah, autonomous, of course. We must have autonomy.
Okay. Facebook.com/JDCrunchman. Up there, you will connect to my wall. You'll know exactly what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. You'll be plugged into the latest ecological news that I've got, including EcoVizzo, the new site we're putting up now, which is pretty much empty. But anyway,
Facebook.com/JDCrunchman. Okay, thank you, John. John Draper, Captain Crunch, our special guest today on the Dr. Future Show. So thanks, folks, for tuning in. Have a great afternoon. It looks like it's beautiful out there. Get outside if you get a chance, and enjoy the rest of the day.
KSCO, Santa Cruz.
See you next week, folks.